First, thank you for inviting me. And second, I should probably start by saying that the reason why I'm doing this is in this room, and it's not John, but it's Cynthia, who invented deconstruction a while ago.
Wow.
He was one of the authors of that, and this is what got me thinking about lettuce. You know, sort of slowly, I got into all dimensions being deconstructed. So this is a talk which mostly we'll talk about the ideas of this paper, but in the end I will also give a lot of plots of results that we have obtained together with Joel Gitt, who is a postdoc in Minneapolis. And I want it to be very informal, so please stop me and ask questions. This is why I got a chalk there. I realize that you probably don't have many lattice talks, and also a lot of the stuff I will be talking about is very weird from the point of view of a normally educated particle theorist such as myself. Mm-hmm. Most of these things I didn't know about a year ago. Okay, so no wonder if you feel like it's bizarre. Okay, so but first I want to set this in a more general framework. Where does it sit, and why I think it's interesting? So let's start. Normally, when we think of QFT, quantum field theory, we teach students usually various expansions. Most often, we teach them perturbation theory, and we stop there. But in general, in quantum field theory, we have a perturbation theory, we have semi-classical expansions, we have 1 over n, and a general feature of these expansions is that they're normally divergent expansions. So they are asymptotes. They're asymptotic expansions of some quantity, and that quantity, that thing to which there are expansions, is the non-perturbative definition of the theory. And you may ask, if the expansions work so well, why do you need a non-perturbative definition? Well, clearly they don't always work well. In particular, in QCD, the ground state is highly non-perturbative. And so you need to actually have a good framework to know what you're doing, to tell what the QCD ground state is like. And the lack of a non-perturbative definition, or of the ability to solve it, even if you have it, in QCD, has sparked another set of tools of trade in quantum field theory. You can call it voodoo QCD. And that consists of all kinds of things, such as models and uncontrolled approximations, starting from ADS QCD, NJL QCD, chiral quarks, Beck, sperm, instanton liquid. You can add anything there, you know, and end with Pythia if you want. there's various points of view on that. The skeptic may say, you know, sometimes these things work and sometimes they don't, and what do we actually learn? Well, the enthusiast will say, well, this is physics and the experiment is well described in many cases. And the truth is probably in both camps. Speaking of non-perturbative definition, what do we know? First of all, there is something called constructive field theory, which is clearly not fashionable these days. It is generally quite abstract. It deals with existential questions, rather questions of existence of the theory as defined by some mathematical things, mathematical requirements such as a positive norm Hilbert space, etc. Most of this approach to field theory was developed in the 1970s, and as far as useful results, there aren't that many. And from my point of view, the most useful statement that came of that approach is the so-called reconstruction theorem of Osterwalder and Schroeder. And it basically says how you relate a Euclidean field theory to a normal Hamiltonian field theory in Minkowski space. And it says that a Euclidean field theory should satisfy some requirements, most notably Osterwalder-Schroeder positivity, in order for it to correspond to a positive non-Hilbert space theory. So that's very useful from my point of view, because most of the lattice work is based on that one way or another. So that much about that approach.
Are you going to bother to tell us what Oster-Schroeder positivity
is? It's what replaces hermeticity in Euclidean space.
Okay.
Yeah. That's basically, it's the best. It's enough. Yeah. Then, of course, there is string theory. Now, we shouldn't forget that string theory has its own non-perturbative definition. But even so, it can be useful. Even if that definition is not there, string theory can be useful if there are enough symmetries around. And in the last 15 years, we have all sent on working on this and that very supersymmetric situation using string theory, at least many of us. Working on this and that supersymmetric situation using string theory, But it is fairly helpless in non-supersymmetric situations. And again, that's because of this, because we don't have a non-perturbative definition. And finally, there is lattice field theory. We all have some intuitive idea of what that is. As far as results, it has proven very powerful in vector-like gauge theory. In particular, in general quantum field theories and in QCD, all rigorous non-perturbative results that actually prove something use lattice at some point. And such results, for example, concern the phase structure, the analyticity near the boundary between Higgs and confinement phase, or the establishment of confinement at strong coupling, etc. So it has been useful for some analytical formal studies, if you want to call them that. And in the most recent years, it has actually exploded in terms of providing real numbers for B physics, and they're competing with experiment right now very closely. So people are very excited about that. It seems that the lattice is probably the non-perturbative definition which is best suited for a generic quantum field theory. There's of course many quantum field theories, such as minimal models of two-dimensional conformal field theory, where you know everything just by symmetry. So for those theories, you don't need lattice. But for a generic quantum field theory, where symmetries don't determine everything, you need something more. So what do I mean by non-perturbative definition, I should say, finally? First of all, you need an equation, right? It should have a left-hand side and a right-hand side. And the objects that we're interested in calculating are arbitrary Green's functions. And by arbitrary, I mean not just, for example, chiral Green's functions, as we often compute in supersymmetry, and we claim that they're exact, but I mean the most general Green's function that you can imagine. And that should have a right-hand side, which should be an object that exists mathematically and can at least in principle be calculated. And now since we're dealing with the quantum field theory, there should be, of course, couplings that enter the Lagrangian of the theory, and that Green's function should depend, of course, on the volume and the ultraviolet cutoff in order for them to make sense. Those things should be there. And then, of course, there is the stage of interpreting how you take the large volume, small cutoff limit, large volume, small lattice spacing limit. So that's my definition of the non-perturbative definition. And if lattice sounds so good, you know we should all be very excited and doing lattice. But as always, when you're very excited about something, you should think, you know, is this really fundamental or is it a computational tool, what you're doing? And so when you think about it, the lattice has good properties, allows you to calculate things, but it also has bad properties. In particular, it likes to break global symmetries. Typically, it breaks space-time symmetries, such as Poincaré symmetry. The way we deal with that, in particular in the Euclidean setting, is that we impose a discrete subgroup of the Poincaré group, such as some z, well, it would be a z4 in the two-dimensional case, and the appropriate discrete group in four dimensions. And if the action has that symmetry, you choose it judiciously so that that symmetry doesn't allow relevant operators which break the continuum limit Poincaré symmetry. So the discrete subgroup assures that you restore the full Poincaré invariance in the continuum limit. Of course, the lattice also breaks chiral symmetry, and that's very bad for QCD because chiral symmetry and its breaking, spontaneous breaking, is an important property of QCD. Of course, as we will see, this is if the chiral symmetry is naive. Chiral symmetry can be modified in a way that's preserved on the lattice, and that will be a major point of this talk. Supersymmetry is also generally broken on the lattice, and only in the last few years we have found that in some supersymmetric theories, typically those with extended supersymmetry, you can think of supersymmetry as you think of Poincaré symmetry. There is some subgroup of supersymmetric transformations that can be exact, and in some cases they assure that the full supersymmetry is restored in the continuum limit. Unfortunately, the supersymmetric theories that I mostly care about and Johnson mostly cares about don't fall into this class. So we're kind of stuck there. What else? What else is bad about the lattice? Well, clearly, it works best when it's Euclidean. Okay, and the problem is that the world is not Euclidean. There are many things that are difficult to compute just based on the Euclidean formulation. And finally, the lattice, at least so I'm told, does not include dynamical gravity. And so the conclusion from this slide is that what I'm doing is probably not the theory of everything, but is a calculational tool which may be useful in certain cases.
Is that just a statement that there's no field theory definition of gravity?
You can say that. Yeah. Although this is not a, you know, there is no proof about that. There are approaches to gravity which use lattice and which may actually be, or people tell me are promising. Okay, I'm not an expert, you know. Okay. So this talk is about formulating non-QCD-like theories on the lattice, and we need to ask the question, why are we doing that? There is, of course, the purely theoretical exercise, which is good by itself, but we live in a pragmatic age, and so there must be some other reasons. Well, first of all, the standard model is a chiral gauge theory. It is, of course, weakly coupled at the energies we know. So really, from experiment within the standard model, we don't have a particularly strong incentive to go to the lattice. There are, of course, extensions of the standard model. And if they happen to be weakly coupled at LHC scales and somewhat higher, there also won't be particularly strong reason for doing non-QCD-like theories on the lattice. But if strong dynamics is shown to be relevant, then the issue of these non-QCD-like theories on the lattice will become very prominent. Right now, it's a sort of a niche thing where a few people work on, of the order of 10, maybe, okay, in the whole world. But it certainly will become more interesting if it is shown that non-QCD-like theories have relevance for experiment. So let's just remind ourselves, how can strong dynamics be relevant? Well, there are supersymmetric extensions and there are non-supersymmetric extensions. In supersymmetric extensions, there is dynamical supersymmetry breaking, and very often that's strongly coupled. Very often it's not. It depends. And as far as supersymmetric theories on the lattice, there has been some progress, as I mentioned, but it's limited. It's limited to extended supersymmetric theories, which are vector-like by nature. And Joel Gitt wrote a review recently that you can consult if you care. Of course, there is the possibility that there is strong electroweak breaking, which has had renaissance as Randall syndrome-type models. Those theories are supposed to be weak coupling duals of large n vector-like theories, and the fundamental dual description is probably strong. And of course, it's possible that there are other not yet imagined, not large n, non-QCD-like theories that break electroweak symmetry. We don't know. Some of my colleagues believe that that's the case. In general, strong chiral gauge dynamics remains largely mysterious. In the non-supersymmetric case, we don't have many tools. The only tools we have are the Twoft anomaly matching and MAC, which stands for most attractive channel arguments. John is very well familiar with those, I think. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's it. These are not very powerful tools. Okay. And analytic methods such as large area expansions, including these recent ADS QCD dualities, do not apply to chiral gauge theories. When I say do not apply, do not usefully apply. And the reason they don't usefully apply is that if you look at the typical chiral theory, this is sort of a prototype theory, SU5 with a 5 bar and a 10. It's a chiral gauge theory, one of the, I guess, most minimal ones in four dimensions. And if you look at its large n extensions, you see that the number of colors, the number of gluons grows as n squared, but the number of quarks does that as well. And one of the simplifying features of large n is that quark loops are suppressed. So this is not the case here. And so it's not very useful to apply large n to chiral theories. So also, if you want to understand interesting supersymmetric theories, say from the point of supersymmetry breaking on the lattice, again, we are tied to the chiral gauge theory problem. So it's the things are intermingled. And so we come to the issue of what actually is the showstopper in doing chiral gauge theories or chiral symmetries on the lattice as well. And the difficulty is usually referred to as what is called the Nielsen-Inomiya theorem, you know, which is a theorem based on some assumptions. But there is a quick argument, and the quick argument is that we know that in the continuum, chiral symmetries can be anomalous, right? Now, if you have a lattice formulation of a theory with a chiral symmetry, everything is symmetric under the chiral symmetry. The measure is symmetric, and the action is symmetric. So so if you had a theory with an exact chiral symmetry on the lattice, if you could gauge it, and then you would ask where would anomalies come from. So there is a clash between anomalies and preserving chiral symmetries on the lattice. So that's probably the quickest way of putting this problem. So, however, in the past 10 years, there has been great progress in understanding global chiral symmetries, and so we'll use them. We'll use this progress. So here comes the plan of my talk. the plan is to start to talking about the domain wall waveguide models and discuss their failure to obtain chiral spectrum. And because we're going to have some proposal of how to remedy this, I need to discuss the anatomy of the failure in a little bit more detail. So I need to tell you some things that are known about lattice that most people don't know. And the first thing I need to tell you is that you can have on the lattice unitary Higgs field and be in the symmetric phase at the same time. And I need to tell you also about the strong Yukawa symmetric phases on the lattice, or which is equivalent strong four Fermi interaction symmetric phases. And I will use these ingredients along with something else that I need to tell you, which is the Ginsberg-Wilson mechanism to enforce an exact lattice chiral symmetry, to come up with a proposal which has some very interesting features that we made with Bocciatari and Matt Martin earlier this year to formulate chiral gauge symmetries on the chiral gauge theories on the lattice. And I will conclude by boring you with a lot of plots and also some analytical results that Joe Gitt and I have obtained supporting this proposal. And finally, I will discuss the outlook and remaining issues. So it's a bold plan, and I have many transparencies, and we'll see how it goes. So let's talk about domain walls. The reason I'm talking about that is that some of the recent progress was sparked by thinking about domain walls. These days, it's easy to talk about domain walls because everybody has done S1 or Z2. Okay. When this was proposed first, that was something very exotic. Right now, it's not. So if we have a fifth dimension and a massive bulk fermion, remember that in five dimensions, a bulk fermion has a two four-dimensional chiral components, left and right. If you have a massive bulk fermion of mass m, and if you impose Dirichlet boundary conditions, which is a consistent thing to do, for example, you can imagine that you impose the boundary condition that the right-handed component is zero at this end and the left-handed component is zero at this end, then when you look at the spectrum, you found that there are two light modes which are localized near the left. The left mode is localized near the boundary where the right-handed should vanish, and the right mode is localized near the boundary when the left-handed should vanish. And the spectrum of light states consists of a light four-dimensional Dirac mode composed of these two light modes whose mass is the bulk mass, but it has an exponential suppression in terms of an exponent of e to the minus mr, where r is the extent of the fifth dimension. And so clearly, as you take r to infinity, this mass goes to zero exponentially fast, and in the limit when the r is infinity, the chiral symmetry is exactly restored. And so this is a continuum consideration using solving the continuum Dirac equation with a mass term in five dimensions with right boundary conditions. And Kaplan's great insight from 1992 was that this story actually persists if this thing is put on the lattice, where you latticize both the fifth dimension and all the other dimensions. And what I'm presenting here is this story in an implementation by Shamir, which is slightly more simplified than Kaplan's. I'm also using a strange notation, which also shouldn't be too bothersome. It is sort of a deconstructed type notation, where every circle denotes a Weyl fermion. So this is a four-dimensional left-handed fermion. This is a right-handed component, and there are n of those. So think of this as just having a vector-like four-dimensional gauge theory of n flavors. So this is one flavor, this is another flavor, and this is the n flavor. Okay? And these lines denote mass terms for these flavors. And of course, these are gauge invariant because the mass term for a left and a right-handed quark is gauge invariant. And now I also include, to relate the various flavors, I include what you can call hopping terms. This one can hop into this one, etc., in this particular way. And it turns out that if I solve for the spectrum of this, I find also that there are two localized modes. In fact, it's very easy to see that because if you put this mass to zero, and if you're in the deconstructed picture, this fermion, this Weyl fermion, does not have a mass term, so this is massless. And so there is one massless mode here, and there is another massless mode, which if you judiciously choose the sign of these hopping terms, you find that it's localized exponentially to this end. And then if you turn on this mass term, clearly there's going to be some overlap between the two modes, and there's going to be a Dirac mass, but if the mass is small, the overlap will be small. And in particular, because this mode is so far located from this mode, in the limit when you take n to infinity, the mass will go to zero. So what this gives rise to is a vector-like gauge theory, and in the limit when n goes to infinity, you find an exponentially light Dirac fermion. And when you take n to infinity, you get an exactly massless chiral fermion. So this is the basis of Kaplan's proposal, of putting a vector-like theory with an exact chiral symmetry on the lattice. The only quote-unquote thing you need is an infinite number of flavors, and you have to take the number of flavors to infinity. It's, again, based on this domain wall idea. And, of course, Kaplan was ambitious when he came up with it, and he said, well, can we do a chiral gauge theory? To do a chiral gauge theory, what you need is two things. First of all, you want the gauge theory to be unbroken, so the gauge bosons should be massless, and you also need the chiral, the light spectrum of fermions to be chiral. So what he proposed is to have this domain wall, or this large number of flavors, sort of split in two. You make some part of the flavors charged under the gauge group, and the other part of the flavors neutral. He called these waveguides because, just based on an idea from electrodynamics, just you have part of the space where the gauge fields talk to. So they don't talk to these flavors, they talk to these flavors. Okay? And so, of course, you know that you have a problem with this link because it violates gauge invariance. This field is charged and this field is not. And so to remedy this, you put a new Kawa coupling with the Higgs field. So you couple the left-handed field at the boundary of the waveguide to the right-handed, the neutral boundary of the waveguide to the right-handed field on the charge boundary using a Higgs field. And you hope that somehow this will help you to achieve a chiral light spectrum. And do you? Does it help? Well, I wouldn't be giving this talk if it did, but I need to tell you why it doesn't help. Okay? And it doesn't help for various reasons in various limits. So let's first consider the limit of a small Yukawa coupling. The ultimate limit of a small Yukawa coupling is a zero Yukawa coupling. If you take a zero Yukawa coupling, this link just goes away, and then you're back to the previous picture. So you get a vector-like theory when you have a one light mode here and one light mode here. And if you turn on the Yukawa coupling small, that doesn't help very much. So these people did a great analysis, and they showed that in the symmetric phase with a small Yukawa coupling, the fermion spectrum is always vector-like. And of course, when you have a coupling, you can take it big and strong, and the opposite limit is to take a very large Yukawa coupling. And I will need to say more about the motivation for this later, so for now, just take it as an exercise. So I have this Yukawa coupling between this left-handed fermion and this right-handed fermion, and it's large. The limiting case of a large Yukawa is an infinite Yukawa, and at a large Yukawa coupling, I see simply, what does it mean? It means that this term in the action, which contains these fermions, is much bigger than all other terms. The way I formalize that is by rescaling the fermions by 1 over square root of y. I cannot rescale the scalar field because it's a Higgs length fixed length fix, which we'll come to later. So if I rescale the fermions like this, then of course this affects their kinetic terms, and in the limit when y goes to infinity, the kinetic terms disappear, and the Yukawa coupling is the only term in the action. So that's called a strong coupling expansion. Okay. Now let's look at the kinetic term for this fermion, for the left-handed partner of this charged guy, right-handed guy, which participates in this Yukawa interaction. So this is its kinetic term, written in sort of a pseudo-lattice notation. It has a normal Dirac term, but in order for it not to have doublers, we need to include this other term, which is called the Wilson term, which couples this fermion to this fermion. Right? So the left and the right and the boundary are coupled. So when you rescaled this fermion by square root of y, what happens is that you rescale in this coupling this guy. And if you do that, in the limit when y goes to infinity, this Wilson term disappears. And when the Wilson term disappears, what this means is that all the doublers come back, because the purpose of the Wilson term is to lift all the doublers. So I should have said that this construction involved using Wilson term. So what these people showed is that to the leading order in the strong coupling expansion, and also to higher order, this waveguided strong coupling also doesn't give light to a chiral theory. The spectrum of charged fermions is always vector-like. And so far, what we find is that the waveguide doesn't work at both weak and strong Yukawa coupling. The reason it doesn't work at weak coupling is that the mirror fermion and the gauge boson mass are both determined by the Higgs path. Remember this, in order to give mass to a tweak coupling, in order to give mass to this guy, you need a VEF, right, to lift this mode. But it also gives mass to the gauge boson, and so it doesn't work because they're either both massless or both massive. And so there was a very interesting proposal by John and collaborators using new ideas about warping. And I won't say much about that, but the main idea of the proposal is to decouple the sources of a mirror fermion and the gauge boson mass, and to do it to do it in such a way that the gauge boson remain massless, but the mirror fermions become heavy. Okay. So in 4D, they found strong coupling issues and couldn't make much progress beyond. You know, if you find strong coupling issues, this means that your study of your classical Lagrangian is not. You know, you wonder whether it's valid or not. And so what we decided to do is to do a 2D study, which I think had better chance, because part of the proposal actually involves allowing the gauge field to propagate in the fifth dimension. So you're dealing with an issue of taking a continuum limit in the five-dimensional theory, whereas in the two-dimensional case, a priori, you have a better chance because you're looking at the three-dimensional theory. And so what we find is that indeed, we don't find the strong coupling problem that they do, but so we conclude that in two-dimensional case, this proposal has a better chance. But indeed, to study whether it's feasible or not, one needs to do a full lattice study. And so far, the only thing that has been done is deconstruction. And the full lattice study seems too difficult to handle. So that's the stage of that. So it's not what I want to talk about, though. But I mentioned it because I thought it was kind of cute. Okay. This talk is looking at the other limit. This talk is looking at the limit of a strong Yukawa coupling. And I will call it the strong Yukawa against propulsion proposal. And those are the two papers. One of them is not a paper yet. Now, to tell you about that, I need to tell you, actually, what was the hope of this strong Yukawa waveguide idea? Okay, why were they actually doing that? And why they were thinking that at strong Yukawa there could be actually something interesting. So I need to tell you about some things that can happen on the lattice that we're not particularly used to. The first thing I need to tell you is that on the lattice, you can have unitary Higgs fields and still be in the symmetric phase. So by unitary Higgs field, I mean what I mean, just a unitary Higgs field. So so here is an Lagrangian for a unitary Higgs field on the lattice. So this is some coefficient, which will play an important role. There is a sum over all lattice points and a sum over all directions. And this phi is a unitary field. Suppose, in the simplest case, it's just U1. So for those of you who are not used to, this Lagrangian basically looks like this, e to the I alpha of x times e to the minus I alpha of x plus mu. And this is being summed over all x and directions, just dropping the gauge field. And this basically looks like a cosine of alpha x minus alpha x plus mu, which if we expand to small differences, is simply the normal difference operators. So this term, which is written here, is simply d mu alpha in the naive continuum limit. Right? So it's also clear that this term gives some mass to the gauge boson, because if you go to a gauge where phi is 1, which you can do by appropriately redefining the u, that's the term which is linear in u, and it gives some mass to the gauge boson. Okay? So clearly, if you gauge the chiral symmetry with the unitary Higgs, you get a mass. So nevertheless, so our naive intuition is that this thing is always corresponds to a broken phase in the gauge theory. Okay, and the point is that it's not always true on the lattice. And the reason is the following. We are tempted to take this Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian is basically this. The Lagrangian is kappa times cosine alpha x minus alpha x, which we have. And there is some toward x and mu hat. So our intuition is to always expand this, right? And the expansion of this gives rise to this derivative, and when you covariantize this derivative, that's a mass for the gauge field. But the point is that if this coefficient kappa is small, this thing that you're doing is not right. Because at small kappa, when you make the kinetic term for this normal, namely, you renormalize the alpha to get rid of the kappa, then you find that the fourth order term is very strong. Right? There will be alpha to the fourth over kappa squared, over kappa, actually. Right? So the interaction term being very large means that the interactions are strong. If the interactions are strong, you're doing the wrong thing. Okay? So at small kappa, what you should actually be doing is not what we just did. You shouldn't be looking at slowly varying fields, because when we do this expansion of the cosine, we're imagining that the field here and the field here are not very different from each other. Right? And the point is that at small kappa, you shouldn't be doing that, because at small kappa, there is no effective suppression of the fluctuations of this field between neighboring sites. One way to think about that is that these fields phi are like spins. it's the best analogy, actually, because they're unitary fields, so they're restricted variables. They take values plus or minus one, right? And if you think in statistical mechanics terms, small kappa corresponds to high temperature, we know that in high temperature spins are disordered. Being disordered means that they're not correlated in neighboring sites. In particle physics language, it means the fields are very heavy, right? This means you can integrate them out, okay? So so all these words are just saying that when kappa is less than some critical value, what you should be doing is not this expansion around slowly varying backgrounds, but instead you should be doing the strong coupling and high temperature expansion. What that means is that you basically expand the exponential of the action in terms of the action, because the action is small. Okay? That's a standard tool in statistical mechanics, and it's a technical way in which you integrate out the Higgs fluctuations. And what you find is that there is disorder, the correlation length of this Higgs field is small, it's irrelevant at large scales, and what it does when you include the effect of the gauge field is integrating out the rapid fluctuations of the unitary field gives rise to a Lagrangian, which is of course gauge invariant. It depends on u. The leading term is of course the Wilson term, and it should go like kappa to the fourth. That's clear without any calculation, because it should involve four u's. Okay, so that's pretty clear. And there is a tower of higher dimensional operators that depend on the gauge field suppressed by the correlation length, okay, which is 1 over square root of kappa. So what is the moral of all this? Oh, by the way, this is due to Fradkin and Schenker from 1979, which referred to an old paper of Wegener's on Z2 gauge theory. It's often called the first Nielsen Inomiya mechanism, and I don't see a reason for that besides the flashy title, Creation of Light for Chaos. Because everything is in the first paper, the second paper just gave some words that were slightly less boring. The reason they called it that is that it's clear, because you know, this corresponds to what you normally would call a gauge-breaking term, because it's a mass for the gauge boson. Right? The point is that when it's small, it's actually washed out by the rapid fluctuations of the gauge part of the gauge field. Okay, that's the essence of the mechanism. And what is important for all this story to be true is that the gauge will be compact. The strong coupling expansion only makes sense if the fields phi are compact, because otherwise the measure doesn't make sense. So that's the first story that I needed to tell you. Okay, which we normally don't
know. Exactly, is the sum over the measure in there?
Oh, I didn't write it. Yeah, I didn't write it. So let me write it, and I lost my chalk. Yeah. You see, when you have a compact field, e to the I alpha, the measure is simply for every x, you have an integral from 0 to 2 pi of the phase.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have the action, you know, if you have an action like that, even if you drop the action, which is the first term in the strong coupling expansion, this whole thing makes sense,
yes,
because it's just one. If it was a non-compact field, it wouldn't make sense. It would be infinity. And then the action would be very important to make this thing make sense. Okay, this is compactness. This is why is compactness important? Okay.
In some kind of limit, do you encounter divergence if you have a gauge invariance in this?
Okay, so I didn't discuss the entire phase structure, but there are no divergences in the strong coupling expansion. In fact, the expansion is finite. It's the only convergent expansion in quantum field theory. The reason is that okay, we're getting the reason is it's very simple, actually, is that the numbers of paths of a given length, which is what this amounts to when you start doing it, is bounded, and you can show that the expansion is convergent. Divergences are encountered when you try to take the continuum limit in the broken phase. The broken phase corresponds to large kappa.
Mm-hmm.
If I have large kappa, then fluctuations are suppressed because the action is large, and then you should be doing what you normally do, namely this. And then, of course, at large kappa, the higher order terms are suppressed by the large kappa. And then there are divergences in the normal lattice sense, if you take at constant gauge coupling the lattice spacings to zero, you get the normal divergences. So it's all 1-to-1. Well, in the symmetric phase. In terms of the chiral Lagrangian, it's like trying to take f pi above the ultraviolet cutoff. Some strange limit like that, which of course doesn't make sense. So the second part, you see, I have to tell you all these things, okay? because I'll use them. The second part is this business about strong Yukawa symmetric phases on the lattice. These were found in like 1989 by these people, and there's all kinds of work on that. The reason you don't know about them is that they're lattice artifacts. Okay, but we're doing lattice, and so lattice artifact is very interesting to us. Okay, but essentially what these people find is that the fermion-Higgs system on the lattice, so you have fermions coupled to Higgs via some Yukawa coupling, okay, on the lattice. There is a phase where the fermions are massive and the chiral symmetry is unbroken, which is normally you don't think it's possible. Right? There is a precursor to that, and the precursor to that is a paper by Acton and Preskill on the same topic, actually, on chiral gauge theories on the lattice. And they showed also the strong lattice four-form interactions also exhibit such a symmetric phase. It's actually not very surprising, because you can turn a Yukawa into four Fermi if the Higgs is heavy. So it is not surprising at all. But I will discuss this because this is what I'll be using. So again, I said that these phases are lattice artifacts. The fermions are heavier than the cutoff. So it's basically like an insulator. You have fermions that cannot move. They just sit there. Okay. And the question that arises, of course, if you have these phases, can you use them to decouple the mirrors? So the idea is somehow that the mirrors will get heavy using this mechanism. They'll get mass larger than 1 over A. But the light fermions, the chiral fermion content of the theory, will remain exactly massless. And there is a long series of paper which says that the answer is no. And the reason in every case is similar to the strong Yukawa limit of the waveguide that I showed before. And the reason is that there is a left-right mixing. I'm not skipping. I will come back. The reason is that there is left-right mixing between via the strong Yukawa coupling. But before explaining that, let me actually go and tell you a little bit about these phases. So I have to torture with one more lattice Lagrangian. We're not done yet. So let's consider lattice fermions coupled to scalar fields, to unitary Higgs field, and to some gauge group. Okay. So the Lagrangian I have here is I have the old thing, which was the kinetic term for the unitary Higgs field. So this is my Higgs field. It's gauged. Right? And then I have what is called naive fermions. So these fermions will have a lot of doublers, but it simplifies the discussion. So I have left-handed fermions living on lattice size and right-handed fermions living on lattice size. My left-handed fermions will be charged under the gauge group. This is indicated by the presence of the gauge field here, whereas the right-handed fields will be neutral under the gauge group. This is indicated here. And there will be Yukawa coupling of the left fermions to the right fermions, and it will be made gauge invariant by the inclusion of the Higgs field phi. Okay, so this is the Lagrangian. What is important here is that these are naive fermions, so they have many doublers. What I will say later is true in any dimension and any compact gauge group. So for simplicity of presentation, I will just specialize for the case where this chiral symmetry that I'm talking about is Z2. So the psi left can go to minus psi left, it leaves this invariant, and it leaves this invariant if phi changes to minus phi, and the psi right is neutral. So this will be the discrete analog of chiral symmetry. What I'm saying, again, is true for any compact group. It's a general statement about the strong coupling expansions. So there are several things to notice. We're going to study the symmetric phase, so taking the limit when kappa is small. I explained already that that means that the phi has very short-range fluctuations. In fact, in the limit when kappa is zero, the propagator of the phi is simply a delta function. And I also take the limit when the Yukawa is strong. When the Yukawa is strong, what this means is I forget about the kinetic terms, just like I did in this waveguide, and the fermion propagator is just this. Clearly, it's delta localized, so it's a very short-range fermion, short-range propagator. It's proportional to 1 over y, and 1 over phi, which is the same as phi, because I said it was z2. This doesn't matter really significantly. And then what you do is you treat... So this is treated as the unperturbed term, whereas this, and this are perturbations. That's the nature of the strong coupling expansion. And then what you find is that to all orders in this convergent expansion, all symmetry-breaking Green's functions vanish. So all Green's functions like this are identically equal to zero. You also find that all matter fields are massive, and you also find that the infrared theory is that of the gauge fields only. So you don't have chiral symmetry-breaking, the infrared is the theory of the gauge fields, and all fermions are massive. And the way that happens is important for me to give some detail. Okay. because I will be doing some modeling or showing some lattice simulations of these quantities later. So what happens is that at strong Yukawa coupling, even though these operators vanish that break the symmetry, you can have a composite operator which binds the charge scalar with the charge fermion into a neutral state. That state can pair up with the neutral right-handed fermion to obtain mass. Similarly, you can have a pairing of the charged scalar with the neutral fermion to obtain the charge fermion, which can also pair with the charged left-handed fermion to obtain mass. You can also have massive charge scalars sourced by fermion bilinears, and you can have neutral mass scalars sourced by the fermion bilinears. And you can study their masses using this expansion. So I'm not doing this. I'm just telling you what values you get for the massive neutral and massive charge fermion. At leading order in the strong coupling expansion, you obtain these values. It's all in units of the lattice spacing, of course. So when y is large and kappa is small, which is the limit you're taking, these masses are all much bigger than the cutoff. Okay, so indeed, these are very lattice artifacty things. But as I said, that's what we're doing. We're doing lattice. So we can integrate all this. And the infrared theory is that of unbroken gauge theory only. Okay? So I told you this. And finally, we can come to the hope of this strong coupling waveguide story. Okay? And the hope was the hope was that the charge mirrors and the doublers, right? On the lattice, you normally have doublers, so you have to do something to them. The idea was the charge mirrors and doublers would bind with the scalars. They would pair into neutral fermions and become massive. The light charge fermions would stay exactly massless, and all of this would happen while the theory would be in the symmetric phase. Okay, that would be the hope. And as the strong coupling analysis that I showed before showed, this fails, and it fails because of the left-right mixing due to this Wilson term. And this was shown in a paper by Goltermann and Shamir, who also studied the expansion in 1 over y to higher orders. And what are the so what is the conclusion from here? The conclusion from here is that this left-right mixing is the ultimate cause for the appearance of massless mirrors. And the fact that the chiral spectrum, obtaining a chiral spectrum, fails already at g equals 0. In all this discussion, there was no discussion of any g non-zero dynamics. The chiral spectrum failed to be obtained for g equals 0. And so the question you can ask after learning about this is whether this light mirror mixing that occurs in the Wilson terms, so the idea was that, again, this one and this one were mixing, and this one has a component in the light chiral mode has some component here. So this mixing was caused the trouble. And it turns out that there are actually fermions where there is no plus-minus mixing. And these are called Ginzburg-Wilson fermions, and this is the third ingredient I need to tell you. And what's happening is that Ginzburg and Wilson showed, or rather conjectured, that there would exist a lattice formulation with lattice fermions with some lattice operator D, such that the normal continuum relation would hold. In the continuum, we know that if this relation holds, namely psi d psi, psi bar d psi is psi left, d psi left, psi right, d psi right. So the trick is that, the miracle, or whatever you want to call it, the idea is that on the lattice there exists a formulation, there exists an operator like this, where this equation holds while there are no doublers. Okay, this is the new ingredient. And I need to tell you about that. The idea is amazingly simple, actually. The idea was put forward by Ginzburg and Wilson in 1982. So they said the following thing. Let's suppose we have a continuum theory, when we have a continuum field psi with this action. And let's suppose that the partition function for this thing in the continuum is somehow defined formally. Okay, so both the measure and the action are invariant under gamma 5 transformation. In other words, this continuum D anti-commutes with gamma 5. And they said, now, let us think about coarse-graining this theory. And we'll coarse-grain it into a lattice theory, and we'll construct the lattice theory by just drawing a lattice on the continuum and associating a lattice value of the continuum field psi by taking it to be the average of the continuum field over the corresponding lattice block. Okay, it's a very simple coarse-graining. So it's clear that by doing this to this continuum theory, you haven't done anything to the symmetries of the path integral. Your original theory had a chiral symmetry. Okay? So that should be remembered by these fields. You have just rewritten it in variables which explicitly break it. But the infrared physics shouldn't care. There should be a remnant of this exact chiral symmetry of the original theory in terms of these variables. And you can say that about any symmetry. But the question is to actually get the mileage for that. And it turns out that for fermions it's possible because the action is bilinear. And what they showed is that this symmetry of the of this relation, which is the embodiment of chiral symmetry in the continuum, is changed on the lattice, and the corresponding operator for these coarse-grained fields can be, actually is very easy proof to show that this relation is replaced by this relation. What is missing here is a factor of the lattice spacing, which are always put equal to 1. Okay. So what this is saying is that if you coarse-grain a continuum theory like this, there should exist an operator. Now this is a lattice operator, it's already well defined. It's, you know, some finite dimensional operator because the lattice is, say, finite on a torus, which obeys this relation. It's clear that because of the factor of the lattice spacing here, the normal chiral symmetry is what occurs for low eigenvalues, but for high eigenvalues, the relation is modified. So this paper was written in 1982 and basically was forgotten. And the reason it was forgotten is that you should realize that this is a very formal development. Namely, it tells you that there should exist such a thing, but it doesn't tell you what DQ is. And the reason it doesn't tell you what DQ is because you actually don't know how to formulate this. It uses some formal manipulations in the path integral to get from this to this, but the continuum path integral you haven't defined. So nobody knew what this DQ was. And what happened in 1997 is that Neuberger actually wrote an explicit formula for this DQ. And maybe I should... Well, it's probably worth writing down. It's not so scary. So, it turns out that you can write a formula for this D, and it looks like this. This D, Ginsburg-Colson or Neuberger, if you want to call it, is 1 plus gamma 5 times gamma times H over the square root of H squared. Now this gets scary, but it's not so bad. Where H is gamma 5 times Y minus D double. Now, so a few things. Gamma 5 is Hermitian matrix. H is a Hermitian matrix. This is the normal Wilson operator. This Wilson operator has doublers, etc., etc. But we are using here the massive Wilson operator. So this one is really 1 over H. So it's a mass which is actually bigger than the smallest eigenvalue of D. Okay, so this is a Hermitian operator. And what is written here is the sine function of this operator. It's really an operator. It's not a function, but it's true that the square of it is 1. Okay. So this operator is very easy to show that this obeys this relation. In fact, it's a consequence of epsilon squared equal 1. You may say, this looks very scary and very non-local, but it turns out that it's not the case. This h over the square root of this thing, it's kind of like a massive propagator with some mass. If the gauge field is not too different from unity, it's not scary. It's vaguely non-local, but not terribly non-local. Okay. So this was a big advance. No, it doesn't matter very much how it came about. Domain walls actually were involved in this. And the big advance is that this explicit solution of the Ginsburg-Wilson relation, together with the Ginsburg-Wilson relation, allow you to show that there is an exact chiral symmetry on the lattice. So there is a bunch of algebra here that one can do. These three relations are equivalent. This is equivalent to this, where this gamma 5 hat is defined as 1 minus d, this d, times gamma 5. And there is also this relation. And it turns out that these three relations allow you to show that there is an exact chiral symmetry. Just taking the relations for granted, as I say, they are equivalent, we can just look at the action. So this is the action for this operator d. Q just denotes the charge. And if we rotate the unbarred field by e to the f alpha gamma 5 and the barred field by this new matrix gamma 5 hat, which also squares to 1, so it also acts as kind of a projector, because of this relation, when you pull the gamma 5 hat through the d, it becomes a gamma 5 and it has a normal minus sign. This shows that this is actually a symmetry. It is sort of a bizarre symmetry, which will be important for us later. And the reason for that is that if you actually look at the transformations, this gamma 5 hat depends on the operator, which connects many sides because of this form. And so the symmetry transformation actually acts in this fashion. The parameter is a global parameter, it's x independent, but the symmetry transformation relates neighboring fields in a way which depends on the localization property of D. This will be important. Okay. So what does this exact chiral symmetry do? Well, using this exact chiral symmetry, you could define left and right projectors, as usual, using this new gamma 5. And so the rule is that for normal non-complex conjugate fields, we'll use normal projectors. For the barred field, we'll use different, the gamma 5 projectors, hat projectors. I should say that all of this is in Euclidean space, so treating psi and psi bar differently is completely kosher. And then this Lagrangian has the chiral symmetry, and of course it has also the vector symmetry. And if I'm interested in the chiral symmetry, splitting into left and right transformations, for a chiral transformation, I do a transformation with P plus and with the corresponding hatted projector for the other field. And the entire reason I'm going through that is to show you that the fact that there is field dependence in these projectors leads to Jacobian. So there is no Jacobian for these guys because the trace of gamma 5 is 0, but the trace of gamma 5 hat is not. And so if I do such a transformation, actually there is a Jacobian in my measure, and that Jacobian, the trace of gamma 5 hat, which boils down to gamma 5 d, precisely is equal to the difference between the number of left-handed and right-handed zero modes of this operator. So
this is the Jacobian in what integration? In the
oh yeah,
in the
yeah, very good. So the deep side bar. So when you do the deep side bar integration, the deep side bar is rotated in a field-dependent way. So every Jacobian is, of course, for an infinitesimal transformation, is the trace of this. The trace of this vanishes, but the trace of this is actually field-dependent, and it doesn't, and it gives you that. And there are a few lines to show that. But this is precisely what you want from a Jacobian of an anomalous chiral transformation. So this formulation actually also reproduces the anomalies of the chiral symmetry in a way that you expect. And also in a situation when everything is very precisely very well defined. So what is the moral? The moral is that in lattice vector-like theories, I'm wondering which slide is that. Just tell me where to go, okay? or you feel free to leave, okay, whatever. I will come to my theory eventually, okay? So what we find is that in lattice vector-like theory, we can have an exact lattice chiral symmetry, okay? It is not the usual symmetry for all modes. Again, the reason is that for the psi bar modes, it's modified by this operator D. So for high-lying modes, the symmetry is modified. For low-lying modes, it's the old symmetry. For modes near the cutoff, it's actually different. There are also exact anomalous chiral vortex entities, anomalous and non-anomalous. And there is axial charge violation in Hooft vertices. So it's a big theoretical success. You know, and if that community had better PR, there would be an article in the New York Times. But there wasn't. Okay? So it has been tested extensively in the Schwinger model, and it works very well. There are cases where there are exact solutions to the Schwinger model in the massless case, and there are some ideas about how the massive case should be paid. It is still more expensive to run in four-dimensional QCD. So the latest advances in QCD for B-physics don't use this operator because they do something else. Never mind, though. But people in Japan have actually gotten a very big computer, and they're actually going to use this formulation to do B-physics. How much it will matter in practice, I don't know, because already they get pretty good results using other methods. In any case, so that's the story that I wanted to tell you as far as the exact chiral symmetry.
How does this meld with the issue of quenching versus non-quenching?
Everything here is non-quenched, right? I mean, we do want to integrate with dynamical fermions.
Yeah, so where is the determinant hiding for your gauge fixing?
There is no, well, on the lattice, you don't need to do that. You don't do gauge fixing.
Let's see, can you remind me why? I just forgot at this point.
The only reason on the lattice to do gauge fixing is if you want to do lattice perturbation theory. Because the integral is well defined.
You're talking about different determinants there. Not the determinant from Fadiev Popov.
Oh, he was talking about Fadiev Popov, right?
Yeah.
The determinant from integrating out the fermions.
Yes.
Altogether.
No, so on the lattice you don't do gauge fixing. For example, for U1 here your measure is just this. From 0 to 2 pi. For SU2 is something like that, where you have some angles,
okay.
You know, whatever you call it, right? So the path integral is completely well defined and it's finite. There is no non-compactness associated with, you know, integrating about gauge modes of A which are non-compact. Everything is compact.
And that's simply because we're in the, you know...
Because, you see, you're not using A
lattice.
Mu.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Non-compact. You're
right.
Using
yeah,
the exponential.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay,
so
you're,
yes. If you want to do a perturbation expansion in this, then you have to gauge this.
Yeah.
On the lattice. Very good. Okay, so that much about QCD. Now, my desire is not to study QCD, not because I'm not interested, but I have nothing to say about it. What we want to do is basically follow the idea of the waveguide. So our goal will be to start from a vector-like theory. It will be to also decouple mirrors and finally get an unbroken chiral theory. Okay, so that's the dream, and the question is, can we do that? So what I can do now is explain the proposal, then give you a cartoon picture, and then give you some evidence. And that's going to take a while. I don't know how you feel about that. So let me explain the proposal, okay? So I can propose in any dimension, okay? But I cannot check and give evidence in any dimension. So this is why I will do a two-dimensional proposal. I know many of you don't care about two dimensions, but my numerical stuff is done in two dimensions. And unfortunately, it's one of these things where numerics is essential. So I will consider an example of a two-dimensional chiral gauge theory, which will be a U1 gauge theory, the so-called 3-4-5 theory. There will be two left-handed fields of charge 3 and 4 of the U1 and one of charge 5. In two dimensions, what you need for anomaly cancellation is that the sum of the square of the charges of the left-handed field equal the sum of the square of the charges for the right-handed field. So these are called Pythagorean model, 3, 4, and 5. Okay. This theory has a bunch of anomaly-free symmetries. There is, of course, the global part of the gauge group, which is anomaly-free. There is what is called the 1-3-3 symmetry, which is anomaly-free, where this field has charge 1, this has charge 1, and this has charge 3. So there are two global anomaly-free symmetries, and there are three fields. So there are three global U1 symmetries. The third symmetry, which I can call the fermion number, where everyone transforms with a charge 1, is anomalous. That's equivalent to B minus L in the standard model, and there is a toothed vertex that violates it appropriately. I have written it here very schematically. So what I will start to is a vector-like theory, where I have a Dirac spinner, psi, for charge 0, 3, 4, and 5. So basically, I will have the fields that I want, the 3, 4, and 5 fields, and their mirrors, 3, 4, and 5, with opposite chirality. There will be a spectator. The spectator field is only required in two dimensions for reasons of preserving Lorentz invariance. So just buy that. In four dimensions, I won't need that. Okay. So there is four Dirac fields, and they will have this action. This operator will be this operator that I erased. Because I'm using this operator, there will be eight global chiral U1 symmetries. Remember, if I had only one set of fields, I had two U1 symmetries, so I had left and right. Now I'll have eight of them because I have four fields. Now the target theory only has four exact classical symmetries. The the symmetry acting on this, this, and this, and the one acting on the mirror. So the idea will be to write terms in the actions. We'd break these eight global U1 chiral symmetries to the symmetry that I want. And the way I will do this is by adding Yukawa couplings with a unitary Higgs field. So I'll introduce chiral components. Chiral components of the field psi will be introduced using normal projectors, and chiral components of this field will be introduced using these fancy projectors. Okay? And then I will include Yukawa couplings, which involve the mirrors, which will violate all the unwanted U1s, but will preserve the ones I want. You can either think of Yukawa couplings, or if you're a four Fermi guy, you can think of four Fermi interactions. In fact, this is very similar ideologically to the Eichen-Preskill model of 1986. So they were seeking to break all the unwanted global symmetry with four Fermi interactions. And so I'll have Yukawa couplings like this and like this that break the eight U1s to the four U1s I want. In the end of the day, I'm not writing them explicitly now. In the end of the day, I will have a formulation where the 3, 4, 5, and 1, 3, 3, which are the exact anomaly-free symmetry of this theory, of the target theory that I desire to put on the lattice, will be also anomaly-free exact symmetries on the lattice. Okay, so the symmetry realization for the anomaly-free exact symmetries is as it should be in the continuum. The fermion number symmetry will have an exact what identity, as I told you before. If you have an operator and you do this transformation, 1-1-1 transformation on it, you should get this, which is precisely the kind of what identity you want, because in the chiral theory, this reduces to this. So this completely defines my proposal. So here's a cartoon picture. So what do we have? We have a full lattice proposal of action and measure. Okay, everything is completely defined what it is. It is formulated both in 2D and 4D. In 2D simulations, I can do on the fringe, you know, using small computers. And the global symmetries of this lattice formulation, including all the anomalous ones, are realized exactly as I would like them in the continuum. Okay, they have the anomaly-free and anomalous word identities as I would want. So the dream is the following. Now we have to answer some dynamical questions. So the dream is this. This picture, thanks to John Turner, slightly modified. Okay. So we have in the infrared the spectator field. We have the 3, 4, and 5 chiral fields. Okay, so these are my massless white degrees of freedom. I have exact chiral symmetries that protect them. So they will be massless. And now I have these mirrors. I have this carry ultraviolet, okay, which I will focus on in the rest of the talk. I have the partner of this one, the mirror partners of this one, the mirror partner of this one, and the mirror partner of this one. And the dream is the following. The dream is that the strong Yukawa interaction, I will use this strong Yukawa interaction, will bind the fermions and the scalars into massive states. And moreover, it will not break the chiral symmetry, just like in this toy model that I described before. So this is the dream. And the main question I want to answer in the rest of the talk is whether this dream is realized or not. I will not have a proof, but I will have evidence. Okay. So the first question I will address is the question of the unbroken chiral symmetry. And then I will address the question of heavy mirror. And the massless chiral matter, as I said, is, well, these guys are guaranteed. We don't know that none of these guys will become massless, right? But these guys are guaranteed to be massless. So let's go one by one. Okay. So I can also present the full action of the model in a full glory. There is the Wilson action. There is kinetic term for fermion. There is a Yukawa coupling for the fermion. And there is this term, this familiar term for a U1 unitary Higgs that I wrote before. Now, because for this Ginsburg-Wilson fermion, this relation is true, I didn't show it to you, but it follows from the Ginsburg-Wilson relation. So the point is that in the action, the plus and the minus fields completely decouple from each other. Okay. So the mirror and the light states don't couple in the strong Yukawas, which was a problem in the waveguide. So it was a trouble for all previous realization of waveguide ideas, except of one, actually. And one idea is the idea by Sundrum and Hernandez, the so-called two-cutoff proposal, where actually for very similar reasons they claim to obtain a massless chiral spectrum. But that proposal has other complications, and all of these came before the knowledge of this exact lattice chiral symmetry. Now, I will study today the model in the limit of vanishing gauge coupling. So I will decouple the gauge fields, and I will just ask the question whether the strong dynamics here in the scary ultraviolet actually does what I want. And if I obtain a chiral massless spectrum and unbroken global symmetry, then you think that you can gauge it and still be happy. Okay? But that's something that I will do in the future. So, in the action, these light fields and mirror fields completely factorize, and they also do in the partition function, in the measure, and therefore in the partition function. So the partition function splits into a light partition function and a mirror partition function. So this has my light fermions, charged, and this spectator, and this is the mirror partition function. So the problem at hand is to show that this mirror partition function does what it should. Okay, and what should it do? It should have a phase where the global symmetry that corresponds to the gauge symmetry, namely the symmetry that rotates phi, remember phi transforms is a fundamental, it's a unitary Higgs field under the gauge symmetry, so I want the phase where when I take the coefficient of the phi kinetic term to be small and the Yukawa coupling to be large, the scalar has a small correlation length of order the lattice spacing, and the mirrors are heavy. So this is the goal. This will ensure that I will be in the symmetric phase and the gauge boson will not have a mass, and this will ensure that the mirrors are heavy. Whew. So there is a quick argument, and there is a, which is unfortunately not precise, okay, and this is where I have to do more. The quick argument goes as follows. the quick argument goes like this. You look at the mass term, which is written in more detail here. So these are the fields that I want to give mass to. It looks like that, where M contains powers of the Higgs field, appropriate powers to make it gauge dependent. If you look at the infinite, you cover limit, you drop the kinetic terms. And so the determinant of the mirror fermions, just the integral over these fermions, which is part of the mirror partition function, is simply then a product of determinants of each x, because this is a sum over x. But it's also gauge invariant and local in x. But the Higgs is a unitary field, so there is no non-trivial gauge invariant made local, made out of a unitary field. It's just one. This means that the fermion determinant doesn't depend on the Higgs. And and moreover, it's just a constant. And therefore, the fermions should be heavy, and they shouldn't affect the unitary Higgs dynamics, because their determinant doesn't depend on the Higgs, so they can't do that. This means that the fermions wouldn't drive the theory into the ordered phase. If they did, that would be a problem. The problem would be that they would generate a large kinetic term for the Higgs, and when you gauge it, there would be a gauge boson mass term. It wouldn't be the symmetric phase. And that would mean you would have to drop the proposal. The problem with this argument is that it's very quick. And the reason is that...
Stop. I thought you wanted to keep some fermions like...
Oh, but you see, I decoupled them in the partition function. And at G equals 0, they only couple through the gauge fields.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Oh, I see. So this argument is applying only to...
Only to the mirror. So
mirror,
I'm, from now on, I'll be studying the scary ultraviolet. Okay, that's
okay,
my goal.
So how do
yeah.
I recognize these are the mirrors up there?
Oh, yeah. There is no way you recognize, because
I
everything
see.
Is going
okay.
too fast. But you see, the 3 minus, 4 minus, and 5 plus are the light, and the 3 plus, 4 plus, and 5 minus are the mirrors. So these are all the mirrors.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. You just have to trust me.
Right.
Yeah. So this argument is too quick, because what it used was this locality argument. This is an elegant notation, but really this x involved the psi bars, and the psi bars are really smeared, because the projectors for the psi bars are non-local. They're not very non-local. They're slightly non-local. In fact, yeah, well, I wrote it here. This looked like a massive propagator, so it should be clear that they should be exponential. So in the limit when the lattice spacing is small, the localization is very strong. There are details on that. In any case, this means that because of the smearing, the mirror determinant actually depends on the Higgs. So you can't say right away that it doesn't drive the theory into the broken phase. And so we don't have a workable analytical on the expansion precisely because of this mess. So what we need to do is to combine the strong coupling expansion, namely taking the limit lambda large, with a numerical experiment. And so this is what we have been doing with Joe Gitt for the last 6 months. The work has two type of aspects to it. There is an analytic aspect, which is the proper definition of the measure. So I wrote it like that, but there is some work to be done to actually write this in the light variables. And finally, there is numerical work, which is to use the result of the proper definition of the measure, which allows you to split the right fermions and the heavy fermions. Right? For every Dirac fermion, I want to keep one component and get rid of the other one. So I need to know how the measure is split between them. And that's not trivial, because the plus and the minus are defined in a crazy way for the barred fields, in a way which depends on momentum. And then I will use this result to do a simulation and study not just the scalar correlation line, but other things. So unfortunately, well, I hate it when people say that in talks, but I have to say, unfortunately for the 3-4-5 models, the fermion matrices are huge, okay? So I need to consider some simpler model. And what I will do is I will consider a theory which, upon gauging, would actually be an anomalous theory. I will consider the Carl-Schwinger model, which is a U1 gauge theory in two dimensions with just one charge field, say right-handed, and there will be a left-handed spectator, and the mirrors are a left-handed charge field and a right-handed neutral field. And this is the analog of the Yukawa couplings, which break all the global symmetries but the global symmetries of this theory. Okay. And even for this theory, the mirror fermion matrix is big, and it's even bigger if you include the kinetic terms, so already it's a little bit of a challenge. In any case, this is the one I will study. And because I don't have gauge fields, I don't have to worry about anomalies. Okay. So the light split of the measure we do make explicit. I don't think you want to see that. Just to show you that there are some variables and some action. Never mind. What is important is this. So what we find is that the fermion determinant is positive as a function of this. So there are two couplings. What is important? There are two types of terms in this theory that need to be added. And I take them both to be large, but the ratio of the two I keep fixed. So this parameter, I will work in the limit when y is infinite, so I will be dropping the kinetic terms, but this will be kept fixed, and everything I show will be a function of the ratio from my Majorana to the Dirac mass.
So just regarding the measure, though, just for a moment, I guess I'm reading that what you do is you use the eigenvalue decomposition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Yes, absolutely, which is fun. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It was 2 weeks of my life in Florence. Yeah. It wasn't so bad. Yeah, I am using the eigenvalue decomposition, yes. Absolutely, yes. So, never mind, this is actually what we simulate. But what is important is that what we found is that the fermion determinant is positive so long as the Majorana is bigger than the Dirac, and that holds for an arbitrary scalar background. Preliminary, I find that this appears to hold in four dimensions as well, so it's kind of nice. What is interesting about this result is that I don't have an analytic understanding of it yet. It is a result of a numerical simulation of this determinant is billions of configurations. By now should be billions. I have a proof for constant backgrounds, constant scalar backgrounds. I have a proof for linear fluctuations around the constant background. And then I tried to see that there is some generalization to higher ones, and I couldn't. But numerically, it's just a fact. So
can you remind me, what does Majorana bigger than Dirac mean here?
It just means that this H is bigger than 1. This coupling H is bigger than 1. This is a Dirac mass. It couples left to right.
Okay.
This is a Majorana mass.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all it means, yeah. And also, actually, in two dimensions, whenever a Majorana mass is equal to a Dirac mass, if you look at constant phi background, there is a zero mode because the matrix is 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay, that's actually pretty easy, yeah. So the determinant vanishes when the Majorana is equal to the Dirac, and it has a sign problem. Sign problem means is when the scalar background changes, the sign changes. That's very bad. That's very bad because in the Monte Carlo it's very unstable. So what we do, okay, never mind this formula. Okay, they exist. What we do is to study symmetry breaking, we study the Higgs susceptibility. The Higgs is the scalar field, okay, which is charged under the gauge symmetry, and we want to know what the susceptibility is. I call it susceptibility because this basically reduces to some statistical mechanical system, but the susceptibility is also the zero momentum propagator of the scalar field, if you want. It's the same thing. Okay? So we're studying the susceptibility as a function of the as a function of this parameter h in the limit when the Yukawa is large, and we want to know whether it rises. And now, of course, in two dimensions, there is no symmetry breaking, so what we're looking at is really the Kosterlitz-Tauless transition. Never mind, okay? Those are just details. So this plot is just showing that we get very similar results. I'll tell you what on the next slides what it means. Actually, that's too detailed. Yeah. So here we can actually put the coefficient of the scalar field kinetic term to zero. So the scalar field is really a random variable. Okay. And we study the susceptibility. And so to generate configurations in the Monte Carlo, we use Metropolis with e to the minus s equal determinant m. It's very slow because you have to calculate the determinant for every phi. But I'm showing is to argue that that the results are very qualitatively similar to the ones that I will do later. What it is showing is that susceptibility, or the square of the Higgs correlation length, is the same thing, or the mass, the the inverse mass squared, is of order 1 if this coupling H is bigger than 1. Remember, H is bigger than 1 when the determinant was nice and positive. So for a 4x4 and for an 8x8 lattice, it's shown
here. So you've chosen the Yukawa equal to 1 here?
No, Yukawa equal to 1 is here. And this is Yukawa
so
bigger than 1. So
like which is the Majorana, which is the Yukawa?
This is the ratio. This is the ratio of the Majorana to the Dirac.
The
so the Majorana has to be bigger.
Okay.
Yeah. What's interesting is at h equal to one we cannot simulate really because the determinant is zero, but at h less than one we can still get some results despite the sign problem, and what it shows is that this susceptibility shows criticality, namely the susceptibility rises with the volume of the system, which is what you expect if you have a massless mode. Right? If you have a massless scalar mode, as you on a finite lattice, the smallest mass is 1 over L. So if you increase L, the mass should increase. So this is what this is showing. The reason I show this is just to say that we try to be really honest and use the proper action to generate configurations. What we did next is to do something faster. We turn on kappa and we generate configurations using the scalar field action and we use the determinant as part of the observable. This is much faster because you don't have to calculate the determinant on every calculation, on every configuration. And this is showing
why,
again.
Why is that?
Sorry?
Guess I've lost track of why that's true.
Oh, because and now we have to talk about. So what you do in the Monte Carlo is that you have a set of configurations phi, so you give the value of the scalar field for every point of the lattice. And what you want is you want to generate a set of configurations which are distributed according to this Boltzmann distribution, right? And use some algorithm to do that. If S is the determinant of M, which is a function of phi, right, to generate scalar configurations distributed like that, you have to calculate the action for every proposed change of phi. This means calculating this determinant, which is very costly. Whereas if I use the scalar field action, it's much easier to do. And moreover, we use something called a cluster. Never mind. Okay, those cluster algorithm. Just believe me that it's much faster, and it does look very similar to this. Okay, so we turn on a small kappa, which is much less than the critical kappa for the pure scalar theory. That's known to be 1.1 on the square lattice. And what I'm showing here is, again, this Higgs susceptibility as a function of the kappa, the ratio of Majorana to Dirac. These are the values for the pure scalar theory without fermions. So if I turn off the fermions, this is what I should get. It's very similar for 4/8 is 16. And so what you see is that if H is bigger than 1, where the fermion determinant is positive, the result approaches, it actually is very close to the value without fermions. So the conclusion from this is that these fermions with this crazy coupling to the Higgs field do not order the Higgs field. Okay? So similar for 0.5, so a larger coefficient of the scalar field kinetic term, closer to the transition to the symmetric phase. So if kappa is bigger than this, this is where the scalar field ordinance is stiffens. They all point in the same direction. Of course, susceptibilities here are properly larger, but also you see that as you have a sufficiently H sufficiently larger than 1, actually the susceptibility with fermions is even smaller than the ones of the scalar. Then we do another probe of symmetry breaking, which is called the Binder-Kunderland, which probes which probes higher order correlations. Never mind, it's very pretty. It's something that goes between 0 and 1 as you go from broken to unbroken, and you see that that's how it behaves. It's very nice. Never mind. Okay. All right. So, basically, I'm going through these operators that I showed you in the toy model. I can also study now symmetry breaking using fermion susceptibilities, because you can have two fermions form a scalar bound state. In this theory, in fact, you can have a fermion. I call this a Dirac susceptibility, because this is a kind of a Dirac bound state with the quantum numbers of the Higgs, and this would be a Majorana-type bound states with the quantum number of the Higgs. So we measure the susceptibility of those guys too, and if they rose with the volume, that will be an indication of criticality of a massless knot as well. So again, we don't find any behavior like this, and in fact the behavior is very similar to the scalar one. This susceptibility falls as H is above, sufficiently above 1. 1.5 is enough. This is the imaginary part, or the phase of this, some measurement of 0 or pi, never mind. And finally, we probe the fermion spectrum, for which I don't have nice plots. I only have raw data. And again, what I discussed in the toy model is that the way I would probe the fermion spectrum is by studying correlators such that a composite operator, which is neutral, of the charged fermion, can bind with the neutral spectator. So these are the possible correlators. Or a charge-bound state of the mirror with the scalar can bound with the charge mirror to form a bound state. So these are the charge correlators. And of course, these are lots of quantities to measure. So what we measure is the minimum value of overall momenta of this quantity, which gives a lower bound on the lightest eigenvalues of this propagator. And oh, I should also say that, of course, we check that all the Green's functions which have, which are not invariant under the U1, they're zero. So if you erase the scalar field here, these are non-invariant Green's functions, they're all zero. That's just you have to believe that it's true. And of course, the first check of this is to compute the fermion spectrum in the broken phase. And the point is that if I take kappa to be large, that the scalar field is all very stiff, and there are only very small spin wave fluctuations around the given direction. And there I can use spin wave perturbation theory. And it's amazing that the fermion spectrum just compute these things in perturbation theory. Just put phi to 1 and use the action to compute this analytically. It's, you know, a couple of pages of algebra. And it agrees spectacularly with the Monte Carlo. I put this sign because I have never done anything like that before. And if you knew what goes into the Monte Carlo, you would be very impressed. And not just this result agrees, but also the spin wave loop corrections to the leading order result. In particular, the scaling with H and kappa also agree. So I believe that the Monte Carlo that we are using is nice. Okay, and so these are some results about the spectrum. So the minimum eigenvalue, this is in units of the Yukawa, which has a units of mass. And what we see here is that for H near 1, there's plenty of light states. And I have many data much closer to H equals 0. So these are the values of H. And these are the values of the neutral and charge for various lattice sizes. If I get closer to 0, that 0.05, I get even many more zeros here. So clearly, this zero modes is visible also in the limit of strong Yukawa coupling and in the symmetric phase. But if I increase H beyond 1.5, I see that the modes have a finite mass, and so all the mirrors fermions are heavy in accordance with what we think happens in the toy model. Whew. So I'm done. It's not so bad. Okay. So what are the conclusions? The conclusions is that at G equals 0, this seems to do what we designed it to do, namely to have a symmetric phase where the gauge symmetry isn't broken and where all the mirrors are massive, and when all the light chiral modes are exactly massless, which is guaranteed by using this exact lattice chirality which decouples light and heavy modes. And in infinite Yukawa, this scalar correlation length remains small. There is symmetric phase. The fermions don't have a large effect, a large disordering effect on the scalar theory away from H equals 1, and the mirror fermions are massive. So we can continue and address the crucial question. Of course, the crucial question is whether the entire thing will work. The entire thing work means that I have to turn on gauge fields. The G equals 0 limit is the leading order limit of approaching the continuum limit, but I need to study what happens when I have dynamical gauge fields. So this limit appears to work better than in any Yukawa Higgs model like that. But before declaring victory, there is quite a few issues to be understood in both 2 and 4 dimensions. We need to look at the next order of the strong coupling expansion in G equals 0, and I must say that it seems to look good. This is a very important question, the corrections due to the gauge coupling behavior. And finally, there is a lot of interesting things that I didn't tell you about. Reproduction of the Hooft vertex and the relation to a construction due to Luscher. And I think that what this construction can do is provide a definition of his measure. But since I didn't tell you what his measure was and what the problem with it was, or the problem of constructing it was, I can't tell you much more, but it's an interesting theoretical question. And of course, you know, you do all this so that you have a lattice formulation of chiral gauge theory that you can actually use. And if you turn on gauge fields and you find that there is a sign problem, then of course, you know, you have done fun works, but it's kind of useless. Okay. So I don't know the answer.
What do you mean by a sign problem there?
So, because if the determinant changes sign when the gauge field changes, right? This means that there will be lots of cancellations in your Monte Carlo data. Typically, 99.9% just goes down the drain. because you see, you have a very oscillating function and you're trying to do a Monte Carlo. Basically, that's...
Right. I mean, is that a significant worry then? Or
it is a significant worry, yes.
And you just have no idea?
I have no idea.
Happen,
in fact, I didn't have an idea here as well. When I started, what happened, I emailed Joe, who is, you know, very good with computers, and he sent me this first plot that I showed you in a few days, okay, saying that the determinant is positive for H bigger than 1. So there are other examples with the sign problem. For example, QCD at finite chemical potential, notorious. Okay, so people cannot do lattice simulations. They have a formulation on the lattice, but it's kind of useless. Okay, so this may end up being like that, maybe not. So finally, what should you take out? I told you how combining some old and new things in the lattice definition of chiral theories, you come up with a proposal using some old things and some new things, and it has very nice symmetry properties, nicer than any model I know, and the preliminary indications and checks in 2 dimensions are promising, and there is stuff to be done in 4 dimensions, of course, etc. So that's my spiel.
Why is there to protect an E1 here? Is there an instant on the two dimensions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you just look in Euclidean space, the S1 at infinity is the same as the gauge plane. So, just like an S3 in four dimensions is SE2. So, that's the simplest thing. So, no, I'm actually very. The simplest thing to do is actually, which I'm trying to ask somebody else to do, but we'll see, is to do this same analysis in four dimensions. And some lessons learned is that, you know, maybe you can do some things much simpler. Because obviously four dimensions is more interesting. It's just that because you're using this complicated operator, analytical things are difficult, so you have to resort to computers. I never have in my previous life, but now here I am. Okay.